And now, it is my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker for today. Julie Patton has been a special friend of mine for a very long time. Actually, I first met her when we were both new members at the Unitarian Fellowship on Scott Street. We've both changed our life paths many times since then. So let me give you just a little bit of her background. She's one of those rare creatures who grew up in Pensacola. She currently is an assistant professor of social work at the University of West Florida. On her way to this position, she studied at Bryn Mawr College and received her master's degree from Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. Her past work experiences includes work as a grief counselor for prisoners in work release programs. She's also been an oncology social work at Baptist Hospital and spent 20 years in various roles at a local hospice. While she was doing her hospice work, she made multiple presentations at professional organizations. She was recognized and honored for her writings, and she was given awards of excellence. She also had publications in a national professional journal. For the last 3 years, in addition to her assistant professorship, which is very engaging, she has engaged also with work in race and reconciliation, a program with monthly biracial and multiracial meetings that she initiated here in Pensacola. It's a discussion of this work, the race and reconciliation work, on the difficult problems of relationships between races in Pensacola that she is bringing us today. And here is Julie.
Thank you. It's always with pleasure that I come to this congregation and this group, because a little known fact is I made my first talk in public at the Unitarian Fellowship on Scott Street. I was somebody who was terrified of public speaking, and one day in this self-led group, I decided, you know, I believe I can do that. And then I was a service leader and did it, and now I'm teaching, and I talk quite a lot. I talk, actually, a whole lot. So, basically, I wanted to start today with a poem by Rilke. And it's a poem about darkness. And the reason that I'm starting with a poem about darkness is that since I've been especially focused on race, I've also really focused on language. And what I see in our language and imagery is that we are in love with the light. We talk about the light. Your symbol is a chalice. You light candles and so forth. And as I've taught at the University of West Florida, it really has concerned me whether all of this emphasis on light is affecting the self-image of some of the students of color that I teach. And so I've looked for images of darkness that are equally compelling, because I think what we know is that it's the interplay of light and darkness that really reflects the totality of the world, but also the silence and the underground spaces in which we grow. So I'm reading a poem about darkness today, and I'll close with a poem about darkness too. And if you want to be sensitive and inclusive to your friends who may not be Caucasian, I would suggest that you also begin to look for ways to affirm the darkness as well as the light, because that's where we come from. You darkness that I come from, I love you more than all the fires that fence in the world. For the fire makes a circle of light for everyone, and then no one outside learns of you. But the darkness pulls in everything. shapes and fires, animals and myself, how easily it gathers them, powers and people. And it is possible a great energy is moving near me. I have faith in night. That's Robert Bly's translation of Rilke. And I would really recommend this book if you're looking for darkness images too, because I love Robert Bly, and this is a particularly good selection of Bly's poems. Now, what I thought I would do today is give a brief history of the race and reconciliation effort, and then talk a little bit about what we've seen over the last 2.5 years, and then make some recommendations and share some thoughts about community for those of you who may be interested in this work. And I hope a lot of you are interested in this work, because we've gotten very strong support from the Unitarian Fellowship group so far. Many of you come to the Race and Reconciliation meetings, and I tremendously appreciate that. It's wonderful to have friends show up when you're doing something that sometimes feels a little risky. So basically, we started Race and Reconciliation in August of 2015. And what prompted it was that on my internet screen every night, policemen were killing black men mostly in cold blood. And there was tremendous interest and concern about this. I had always heard stories about the police and the fear of the community of color of the police, but I really had never seen real people being killed occasionally in real time. And so I was awfully concerned about that. And then I went to a meeting on policing that was sponsored by Tiger Bay Club, and the head of the police department, David Alexander, was talking, the sheriff, Lumen May, Lieutenant Timothy May. And there was a discussion of all of the fears that the African-American community had from the police. One that really stuck with me was when Lieutenant Timothy May talked about how he and his brother Lumen May walked down to Belmont de Villiers to look for property for their business and were stopped at gunpoint by the police. And so all of that made an impression on me and was very much on my mind and heart when that weekend Lumen May was stopped for driving, essentially. He was stopped by a policeman who ran his tag, didn't know that he was the county commissioner, didn't know clearly that she was stopping him in front of his office. And it was just a very grim situation. Now, Lumen May lost his temper and was much angrier than the community was comfortable with. And so what ensued from that was enormous criticism of Lumen May. And I wrote a viewpoint for the paper at that point, saying that I could certainly understand why Lumen May was angry. If I had been stopped 101 times for driving my truck that I'd had for 10 or 12 years, I had not stolen this truck, I had not whatever, I would have been blowing up fairly regularly. Those who know me know that there are times when I certainly lose my grip in ways that I later regret, but I don't have a lot of patience with being stopped by the police for no reason. And so I ended the editorial by saying that if there were people who were interested in talking about the racial tensions in Pensacola, have them please get in touch with me. And 33 people did. 33 people wrote to me. And that was the group that started Race and Reconciliation. Now, when we started, I had a very different idea about what we would be doing compared to what actually ensued. I guess I thought we would be solving problems, we would be doing things, We would be active, and I thought maybe racism had, you know, a year or two tops before we had really taken care of the problems here in Pensacola. And we made a list of all of the reasons people had come and the things that they were concerned about, and we divided them into categories that were really kind of action groups, and we went on with the regular meetings that we were having. What happened was a surprise to me, because what happened was that, first of all of the things that people listed as concerns of theirs were things that really would not require any laws to be changed. What they were naming and listing were issues of attitudes and cold-heartedness and lack of empathy. And so those were not quite as easy to act on, because they had to do with the leadership of Pensacola, the culture of Pensacola, and the heart with which we approach the people who are marginalized in our community. In addition, people really seem to need to tell their stories. And folks were quite interested in hearing the stories of people who were different from themselves. And so what we were doing quickly changed in my mind. And what we were doing was basically making room for people to tell their story. I'm really like the sort of meditation that we had today. We start every race and reconciliation with a meditation that's largely silent and just based on the relaxation response, because that's the common denominator in the spirituality that most people bring, and it certainly didn't seem appropriate to espouse any particular style of praying or any particular style of centering. But instead, we just ask people to examine their intention for the meeting, what they bring to it, what they'd like to take away from it, and so forth. And we've really continued to do that. We also got a fair number of children, which was a surprise to me. So that I found that in the process of, for example, arranging speakers and so forth, I had to put together a bag of tricks, which I meant to bring in, and I'm sorry I didn't. And I've collected a huge bag of dolls that are not white, of action figures that are not white, of coloring books that include people of color, so that people can actually see themselves reflected in the toys that the children are given to work with. My students really jumped on board. Many of them came. Dr. LaSharon Wiley, who was at the university at that point, has been the steady co-leader, even though she's recently left the university. And what we started doing was basically arranging a series of programs that, in a sense, are educational in nature. Now, I say educational with some humility, because I have found that I can't presume to educate often. I can only give people some thoughts and some points of discussion, and that's really what we've tried to do. So we try to make room for everyone to bring their spirituality and their story and their intention to make this a better place. So how has it gone? It's gone very well. When we first started, I was kind of scared because, as I said, on YouTube and on my computer every night, people were being killed. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of all kinds of things. And what I feared at first was a lot of really contentious discussion. But I quickly found that that was not what was happening at all. It's not a contentious place. We've had a couple of moments of tension that mostly have to do with white privilege. One of them is a program that we did on feminism and womanism and what the differences were and what the problems were between black women and white women, why black women didn't support white feminism. And at one point, there were panelists who were talking about black feminism and saying things like, don't talk over me. Give me a chance to speak. Don't assume that the white male is the person who has permission to speak and who has the expertise on every topic. And somebody stood up and said, well, you know, if we talk about the difficult situation that we're in now, what I don't really understand is, why didn't black people get out and vote? Why didn't you get out and vote? Well, one of the women who was talking was obviously disturbed by this, but she tried to explain that she had gotten out and voted. Both of the women who were talking had knocked on doors, had really worked a great deal for the Democratic Party, which was their choice. But the man kept explaining that that was not what he meant, and talking defensively about how he wasn't racist, and explaining where he came from, and that he grew up poor, and all of these things. And the black woman tried to say what she was saying. And then the most powerful thing was that she just stopped talking. And she said, whoops, white man talking. I need to shut up. And she just did. Well, that really got people's attention, especially the attention of the white man who had been talking. And there was enormous criticism and anger towards the black woman who had said that. And there was discussion about it. There are other people in my department who participate in the program. One of her professors, because she is a social work student, my social work student, one of them was just furious with her and just thought she needed to comport herself in a different way and all the rest of it. So that brings me to one observation, which is that there are tremendous generational differences both in the black and in the white community. And one of the generational differences is that older black people, and again, I say this with humility, these are just some observations, my observations, not God speaking. But in the black community, older people appear to have made an adjustment to the situation that surrounds them. And the sort of people, for the most part, who come to Race and Reconciliation are people who've been pretty successful, and they feel that that's because of their hard work and so forth. And they are very impatient with younger people who want anything to be different. We also started a parallel series of discussions out at the university called Discussing the Undiscussable, led by LeSharon Wiley. And I was amazed in those first meetings at what some of the black employees said that really supported the oppression of black people in some way. And so there's a lot of tension between the generations and a lot of feeling on the part of elders and people who participated in the Civil Rights March, for example, that they should be in charge and that the younger people in their racial group need to shape up. They need to pull up their pants, stop showing their underwear, get rid of their dreadlocks, a whole variety of things. And so they disapprove of practice and practices of younger people. Older white people also are very difficult to work with at times in this group because they feel that they know what the problem is. The problem is, many people have said, that black people need better role models. There were a lot of women who went to Trinity Church, which is the church that I grew up in, and they really felt that they didn't see black and white, that they were not prejudiced at all, that these role models needed to be available to people, and after a while they left. They stopped coming. What I quickly began to see was that basically the problems I saw were with white people almost exclusively, that they involved white supremacy, that they involved this idea that we needed to be the ones talking, we needed to be the ones organizing and so forth, and sort of a paternalism within that was not really willing to turn over the responsibility for how the group came together and what was discussed and so forth to people of color. White people want, again, in my observation in Pensacola, to talk. They're very defensive. They get very defensive. They want to talk a lot about how they're not racist, how they grew up poor, how they've had many of these experiences. But, of course, the problem with that is that if some white person, especially a man, is talking at this point about himself, what that means is that the focus is on the white person. It's not on the black person's experience and what we're trying to learn about. And so that has certainly been an issue. So I guess that we have continued to discuss along. We've tried to make a lot of space for people of color to tell their stories, to talk about their issues and so forth. We've made some mistakes, and I think I won't talk quite so much about those because of the time issue, but just move on to some reflections and recommendations and a little bit of a thought about the future. One of the major reflections that I see is the need for cultural humility. I'm a social worker. I've been a social worker my whole life. And recently, we have had competencies for social workers and people trying to help. And one of them is this issue of cultural humility, to treat the marginalized person as the authority on their own lives and on what they need, and to regard oneself as the learner. So it sort of turns the tables on the authoritarian model that we've had in the past, and it leads more towards asking people what they need rather than doing what you think they need in terms of your understanding of the world and what's been helpful to you. So that one of the real issues that's being discussed on social media right now is letting people of color take the lead and supporting their efforts rather than coming in with ideas of your own that you would like to see implemented. I remember after the first meeting we had, Laura Edler, who's often my teacher out at the university, she's an older woman who has lived in Inglewood for her whole life. She's running for school board in District 3 right now. And she is very cautious about interactions with white people. She doesn't let them in really very easily. So I was so excited by the turnout that we had in the first couple of groups, the list of things people wanted to work on. And so I threw it all into a spreadsheet. I love spreadsheets. You know, I love logic. I love plans. And so I threw it all into a spreadsheet, and I came in with it, and I had the problem and the domain that it affected and what some possible responses might be. And I showed it to Laura proudly, and Laura says, "How do you know that these people want this stuff? How do you know they need this stuff?" It was stuff like jobs, money, you know, all kinds of things like that. And I'm like, well, how could they not want it? How could they not? You know, these are just good things. But Laura took me down many notches at that point. And I find that I constantly have to remind myself about cultural humility and asking people what they need. Also, not arguing. If someone says that they have been affected by prejudice, you can almost always think, as they describe what their experience was, that there are other explanations for what's happening. And it's very tempting to put forth these other explanations and to say, "Oh, you know, I'm not really sure he meant that," or whatever it is. And that's really a very bad approach, because people don't feel heard, and they feel that you're minimizing their experience and their pain. And so what's important to do is, when you have these thoughts, to think about it yourself like the Lumen May driving stop and being stopped 101 times in your truck, and think of it not as an isolated incident, but part of a pattern. And to support the person while working out your own interpretations of what's happening with your own people, with your own tribe. You know, if you're having problems adjusting to something that's happening, don't make that the issue of the people of color that you're trying to be allies to. Talk about it with your friends in other situations. Mary and Paula and I spend a lot of time working out these things in private, because sometimes the things that people are talking about verge on the tedious. I'll say there's been a huge argument about the pink pussy hats and the march yesterday. And it's been a virulent argument that's gone on for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And it's based on, in my view, a misinterpretation of the symbol. But I'm not the one who's being affected by the symbol. And so what I've tried to do is really work out my own problems with that with my friends. I think the other part of it is that basically sometimes I think the reasons are ridiculous, the reasons that people are objecting to things. But I think that some of what they have to do with is the real need of people who've been marginalized to approach the world on their own terms, to be able to define the terms of the argument, and to say, these pussy hats are a symbol of white feminism. They offend us in a variety of ways that sometimes are hard to identify. And then to have white people just say, okay, we won't wear them. We won't wear them. Nothing but respect for the concerns that the white and transgender communities are bringing forth. And the other thing that we've seen is a lot of cultural differences with, we were having a meeting the other night about a project that Bill is really supporting, are kind of taking the lead on. And one of the major people that we wanted to have interested was a woman who came an hour late. Well, she always comes an hour late, and that's okay. I think that partly, again, what's happening is a need to approach the world on her own terms and just have that be accepted and not be expected to fall in with white people's idea of what time is about and what time you should show up and how you should manage yourself. So I try to be respectful of that. As I said, I'm very cautious with light imagery because I love poetry. Lots of poetry is about light. We talk about inner light and finding the light, but I try very hard to balance that so that I'm not always putting out into the world the expectation that light is good and darkness not so good. The other thing that's happened for me, I know, Paula's telling me that I'm running out of time, and I knew this would happen, and I really tried to be respectful of time, but I'm going to take another probably 10 minutes. So the other thing that I really try to do is, let me just think what it is, because that was distracting. The other thing that I really try to do is, okay, Paula, you tell me, is be a servant of the process. I guess that what I've realized as I've walked through this is that I'm not in charge of how this works out, and it's not up to me to make it work out better or worse or anything. What I'm trying to do is what Joseph Campbell talked about when he said that the best you can do is lean towards the light, okay? And then you have to trust the process. You have to trust that the process is going to unfold in some way that's much larger than you, and that you're not controlling. The other thing about darkness to me is that often it's an inchoate unshaped thing. like, for example, the world in the Genesis myth before it was created. And in that darkness, things happen. And they happen outside of your intentionality. And I think that it's important in terms of cultural humility and personal humility to just have some faith that something is at work here besides you and your intentions, and that things will move along in the way that they're supposed to. I keep myself encouraged in this process by basically wearing my heart on my arm. So I've got a Black Lives Matter bracelet here to remind me. I have a Nevertheless She Persisted bracelet to remind me. I have an I Am Still Learning one of how important faith, hope, and love are. And Julian of Norwich's mystic realization that all shall be well and all manner of things shall be well. And I think that it shall be well, not just because it's tending towards being well. Bill gave me an article last night on the moral arc of the universe tending towards justice, and it was kind of questioning that. I guess that my own personal view at this point is that the interplay of light and darkness and good and evil and intention and chaos is constant, and that it takes us, all of us, all the time to be fighting chaos and injustice and all the rest of it to realize that intention that all shall be well. You screw it up regularly, and that's really okay, because it's from my brokenness, from your brokenness, from the ways in which we've suffered and screwed up that we really are able to reach out to other people who are suffering as well. But I think the other point with that is that if you're, what you're trying to do is be a racial ally, at this point, it's not very helpful to talk about your own suffering. It's just not. There's a universality to it, but if you're the white person standing up at the meeting saying, oh, I've experienced that too, and this is what happens to me, once again, you're making it about you. Everybody's listening to what's happening with you rather than listening to the experiences of minorities and examining your own assumptions that have led them to be in such an oppressed position. And so I think that what white people are called to do at this point is very frequently just to be quiet and listen. And so I think what I want to close with is just the importance of a deliberate effort to let black leaders take the lead. Don't presume to be the person who decides who's worthy or not. Let them take the stage. Feature experts in the minority community. Expect disagreements. What we know about the stages of group formation is that democracy is messy. Bob Graham was here saying that last week. And that life is messy unless people are suppressing their reactions to things. I think in the Caucasian community, we're very good at suppression. We like for things to be kind of smooth on the surface. And I think it's having the faith in the universe and in the process to open it up and let people say whatever it is that they wanted to say. Be very careful with group development. It's really easy to move into a situation where it's mostly white and where mostly men are taking the lead. You don't even realize you've done it because it's just so natural to the way in which our world is structured and what we expect. And find the images that sustain you. Try to focus on what unites us. And understand at this point that intersectionality will be an issue too. If someone is black and transsexual, that's going to be more of a problem than if someone is white and transsexual. If someone is black and a woman, that's going to interact with how she relates to to men or in a variety of other situations. And so understand that in this very chaotic environment that we're in, there are all of these intersecting features. And the last thing is that change happens gradually. One of my favorite people is a woman named Carolyn Mace, and what she says is that resistance is an effort to slow down the rate of change. So you can expect resistance. It's not bad. It's just natural. People are struggling at this point to keep up and to interact appropriately in this very contentious situation we're in. And so they're going to resist a lot, often of very good suggestions. And that's okay. It just slows things down some. One of the things that I have thought about the gender issues and the sexuality issues was that the rate at which gay marriage became the law of the land was very, very, very rapid and surprising. I think that there are senses in which the Trump presidency right now is reacting to how fast change has been going. And that if we can be more patient with each other and slow it down, we'll have more success. I'm going to close with another poem about darkness. And then I'm also going to say that I like to eat. And my effort will be to wait out your community meeting and then go to lunch. And so if anybody's interested, I think that's going to happen. So another poem by Rilke. I love the dark hours of my being, in which my senses drop into the deep. I have found in them, as in old letters, my private life that has already lived through and become wide and powerful now, like legends. Then I know that there is room in me for a second huge and timeless life. And so what my message today is to make room in you for a second huge and timeless life for all of us and for our nation. And to recognize, too, that race is a social construct and that even though we talk about black and white, I don't know what other words to use, really under the skin, we have the same DNA. And so we're talking about something that's artificial and constructed. So trust the dark hours of your being and make room for that very wide life that I think is possible beyond all of these divisions and lines that we draw. Thank you.